Would you care to read with me Paul's epistle to the Colossians, chapter 1? We'll break into the chapter at verse 12. Giving thanks unto the Father, which hath made us meet to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light, who hath delivered us from the power of darkness, and hath translated us into the kingdom of his dear Son, in whom we have redemption through his blood, even the forgiveness of sins, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. For by him were all things created, that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions, or principalities or powers. All things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and by him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. For it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell. And having made peace through the blood of his cross, by him to reconcile all things unto himself, by him, I say, whether they be things in earth or things in heaven. And you that were sometime alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now hath he reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable in his sight. We will confine ourselves to that reading, as I would like to speak verse by verse on some of these verses, and God will bless the public reading of his word. I suppose it would be difficult indeed, if one weren't just a casual reader, to read chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation, those letters to the seven churches, and not see some indication of failure in the church's witness, culminating in the state described as prevailed at Laodicea. It is interesting to note that this epistle, with the epistle to the Ephesians, was requested to be read to that same church. The message is relevant today, very much so. The teaching of these verses we have read together are the very bastions of the Christian faith. For we are surrounded by cults and pseudo-spiritual movements which are not without impact, and a growing blatant worship of the occult as well. While we are not interested in finding out about these things, perhaps, or even reading about them, it isn't very easy to live one's life day by day and not come into contact with some people who think about them or read about them or are interested and may ask questions. And we should, the scriptures say, be always ready to give a reason for the hope that is within us. And so I think that the verses we have read are very relevant for today. Paul knew this, and he faced his world full-breasted. He never felt any need to evade or dodge a difficult issue so far as what he believed was concerned. But then, he knew the risen Lord, and his theology was based on an unshakable experience with the risen Christ. Furthermore, he knew and he believed that the permanent value of the Christian faith
was the absolute supremacy and preeminence of Jesus Christ. He never lost an opportunity of making mention of the glory of his Lord. That's very much what's in my mind this afternoon. Had we gone back a little bit, we would have read in verse 11 of this first chapter about the power of Christ's glory. You may recall that writing to the Corinthians in the second letter, chapter 4, he talks about the gospel of his glory. And in writing to Titus, he talks about the appearing of his glory. In writing to the Romans, he makes mention of the liberty of the glory. And in Philippians chapter 3, he writes about the body of his glory. And at the end of this first chapter, he talks about Christ in you, the hope of glory. Now you will remember that Stephen, in his long address in the book of the Acts, said this: it was because of the revelation of the God of glory that Abraham was enabled to leave Ur of the Chaldees. And I believe with all my heart that it is an apprehension of the glory of Christ through the power of the Spirit that will enable us to resist the eroding efforts of our adversary to diminish and dilute and even destroy our faith and help us to wage a truceless war against evil. Now, if the Philippian epistle was written before the Colossian epistle, and I'm not saying that it was, then already in chapter 2, much mention has been made of the glory of Christ, his pre-incarnate glory and his incarnate glory. But to that passage is added this great Christological passage, in which he tabulates under seven headings, I suggest to you, the glories of Christ. Verse 14 is the first one: in whom we have redemption through his blood. And just for a moment, I would like to draw a few scriptures together and make mention of his redemptive glory. It's not a New Testament title, of course. Job was familiar with the title. He said, "I know that my Redeemer liveth." And you can never deny a person his or her experience. David, we read, rejoiced in God, his Redeemer. But it is Isaiah I like to read, for he uses the title some 13 times. And with it he brackets a little phrase, "the Holy One of Israel," thus bespeaking his deity and his humanity in connection with the title. And I like that. But of course it is the book of Exodus that treats of redemption. And there we read of divine pity. For redemption has to do with divine pity, in contrast to atonement, which has to do with divine righteousness. Redemption has to do with degradation and misery. Exodus tells us that the Lord looked down and he saw the sorrows and the affliction that had brought Israel into all the degradation of the Egyptians with their pagan customs and rites. Degradation and misery, whereas atonement has respect unto guilt. There are several words in the New Testament which are used for redemption. A few of them, because they crop up in our passage, mean to purchase, or again, to purchase in the market. To purchase, if you like, in the slave market of sin with reference to the gospel. Or to deliver by paying a price. In the 13th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, you remember it said, "The kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man who found treasure in a field and hid it, and went and sold all that he had, that he might purchase the field." In a general way then, redemption, and the glory of redemption, has to do with the price paid, the purchase price paid for the world. You remember, Peter says this, I think it's in the second epistle, chapter 2 somewhere, near the beginning of the chapter, he says, there are some people who, by evidence of the way they live and what they say and do, deny the Lord who bought them. Purchase, you see. Writing to Titus, or to Timothy rather, in 1 Timothy 2, I think it is, he says, concerning Jesus Christ, who gave himself a ransom for all. Isn't it John who says that he is the propitiation for our sins, and not for ours only, but for the whole world? His redemptive glory. He paid the price. For we are not redeemed, says Peter, with corruptible things, silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ. But then there is the consequence of sin from which people are redeemed. And this is something that I love so far as the redemptive glory of Christ is concerned. In gospel preaching today, we hear very little about the curse, about wrath bearing. And in Galatians 3:13, there's a little verse that says this: Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. While in Romans 3 verse 24, that well-known verse, we read that we are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. There's another thought which perhaps concerns Israel as a nation more than it concerns you and me. It is retrospective. It's a little verse that occurs in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 15. It says this, that by means of death, redemption was accomplished for transgressions under the first covenant. But what is so important to you and me today in living as a Christian, in witnessing as a believer, in the manner and mode of our living that doesn't seek to hide from others what we are or whose we are? The New Testament tells me this, that we are neither the servants of men, nor are we the servants of sin. And therefore, he gave himself, says Paul writing to Titus chapter 2 verse 14, that he might redeem us from all iniquity. That's the kind of people we ought to be. And to purify unto himself a peculiar people, zealous of good works. But there is a future aspect as well. We are redeemed, we are a purchased possession, but we are still in the body. And this is a body of sin, and it's a body subject to death. But I read in Romans chapter 8 that this whole world groaneth and travaileth until now. It is old and decrepit. And we ourselves, waiting for the adoption, we wait for the redemption of the body. I love that. You know, there's a whisper from the glory of the coming of the Lord. And I am one who want to say to you today that I believe with all my heart that it must be soon. It's not the subject of my deliberations today, but I never like to lose a chance of saying it. I believe that Jesus Christ is coming and coming soon. I believe that the perilous times of which we read are the times in which we live now. In Philippians 3, I am comforted by the thought that he will change our vile bodies and fashion them like unto his own body of glory. But verse 15 says this, that he is the image of the invisible God. And we're introduced to his incarnate glory. Now on the night of his betrayal, the Lord, in speaking to his Father, made mention of the glory he had with him before the world was. If I may reverently suppose, that perhaps pertained to the insignia of deity. For I read in Psalm 93 that he is clothed with majesty, and in Psalm 104 that he covereth himself with light as with a garment. But there was a time in the divine punctuality of heaven called the fullness of times, when God sent forth his Son, and he who made himself of no reputation before he came, doffed his robes of light, divested himself of that insignia, and exchanged them for the swaddling clothes in which Mary wrapped her baby boy, and laid him in a little manger whom the heaven of heavens cannot contain. Wondrous his humiliation to accomplish our salvation. Thousand praises be, Lord of glory, unto thee. But both prior to and subsequent to his incarnation, he possessed all the essential attributes of deity, as we shall shortly see. But I want to think of his body for a moment, the glory of his incarnation. In the upper room, he took bread, you remember, and he said, "This is my body." In the Garden of Gethsemane, he prayed, and his soul was exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death. And on the cross, we read, he dismissed his spirit. He is the image of the invisible God, and the little word "is" means abiding reality. Because it is Christ as Son who is presented as the author of redemption and the forgiveness of sins, therefore his mediatorial person and office is in view in the glory of his incarnation. He is the image, he is the Word, he is the impress, all bespeaking a singular relationship with his Father God. Now we read in the Scriptures that Adam was made in the image of God. And so we conclude that before Adam was made, the image was in existence. The archetype, if you like. Therefore it is impossible for us to limit, either in incarnation or in pre-incarnation, the one who is the image, the impress, or the Word, for his is an eternal mode of substance. Moreover, the word likeness is never used in the relationship between the Son and Father. Just before you say, "But what about Philippians 2:7? He was made in the likeness of men." That verse is inserted there to establish his divine nature. And perchance you are thinking of Romans 8, where it says, "God sent forth his Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin to condemn him in the flesh." That is to establish his sinless nature. And so as John considered the man as he knew him, he said, "We beheld his glory." And as Peter wrote of the one who filled his mind as he was impelled to write these words in his letter, he said, "We were eyewitnesses of his glory," or if you like, of his majesty. Verse 16 is a very emphatic verse. "For by him were all things created. In him, by him, and for him," says that verse, "all things were created." Now the work of the 6 days displays a vast creative energy, a past and a perfect work. The continued existence of creation as it is a monument and proof of his power, who upholdeth all things by the word of his power. He is creator and sustainer. As firstborn, he is denoted as the absolute heir and sovereign lord creation. And if you're concerned about locality, the verse takes care of that, verse 16, for it says, all things were created by him, whether they be things on earth or things in heaven. And if perhaps that isn't enough and you're concerned about the essence of the things, it says whether visible or invisible, all things were made by him. The celestial hierarchy were created by him. I don't think the verse suggests any rank in the way they are prevented, but it does say this: thrones, dominions, principalities, and powers were created by him. But creation itself is unlimited. There is no limit to space, and the further we penetrate into space, stars neither become scarcer nor dimmer. Would I be forgiven if I say to you that I have found quite a lot of topical interest in what is being said about space travel today,
just in relationship to what I read in the scriptures? For instance, as I look up into the sky, and you do sometimes on a starry night, there are lots of little pinpoints of light that seem to have congealed together into one sparkling radiance. But I'm told on excellent authority that every one of those is a distinct and planet of its in its own, most of them much bigger than the one on which you and I live. And that the rays of light from that remote nebulae have perhaps travelled 2 million years to reach us. And the mind boggles at astronomical statements like that. But he created them all in his love and omnipotence, by his mighty power. And then again, we are told that the nearest star is 21 billion miles away, and that between it and us there are room for 12,000 constellations just like our own. What a wonderful saviour, what a wonderful creator, what a wonderful person is the Lord we own and we adore, and we so little think about him like this. But he is the mighty creator. The things we do think about sometimes, the things that we see and can understand, thrill me. I've sometimes had to live in the city, not often or for long. Mostly I've been fortunate enough to live in a little country village, because I love the country. It never ceases to make me marvel. But it was the words of Jesus, the voice of Jesus, that said, let there be light. And an entirely new ethereal substance spread through space. It was the command of Jesus that drove the turbulent waters back into the ocean bed his hand had scooped up. Was the thoughts of Jesus that splintered the mountain peaks that we find so lovely, these everlasting hills of which we sometimes sing. And through their glens and valleys from his own chalice he poured those streams that we call rivers. It was the fingers of Jesus that made the earth verdant and green, that planted the forests and the brakes in which the denizens live, that people them, and every insect that buzzes and every bird that sings proclaims the glory of his creatorial power. He rolled the stars into orbit, I read in the Old Testament scriptures, that we might keep time on nature's dial. But best of all and most wonderful of all, he made man in the image he himself would assume in the fullness of time. His incarnate glory, we said. He is the firstborn of all creation, as well as the only begotten, and has an unshared relationship with the Father
as sovereign Lord and absolute Creator. Verse 18 talks, though, of his ecclesiastical glory. And he is the head of the body, the church. Now, in the second chapter of this epistle, we read of some who did not hold that Christ was head. And there are many people today who are suggesting all kinds of things that impinge upon the literal truth of this divine and precise and accurate statement. He is the head of the body of the church. Paul therefore boldly projects that in the realm of spirit, Christ is supreme. He has lordship over his church, just as the head is in control over the body. Now, in the Corinthian epistle, if you remember, the first letter in chapter 11, he talks about the head of every woman is man, the head of man is Christ, and the head of Christ is God. And he has in view the servant character of the individuals who make up the church, and the exercise of their responsibility in glad submission to him who is the head over the church, as the evidence that they have the new life that he gives to those who make up the church, which is his body. I would expect to find then, when I test these scriptures by other scriptures, and after all, they are their own interpretation, that this is so. And so I find in Ephesians 1:22 that he is head over all things to the church, and I look at this and I ask questions. And my questions are answered in this, that by virtue of his death and resurrection, he said this, all power is given unto me. Not some power in heaven or some power on earth, but all power is given unto me. And almost in the same breath he says, and go ye into all the world and disciple the nations. How can we do this? As head over all things to the church, he is its source of life, its energy, and its power. And any power we have, or any energy we have in service for him, must come from him, and will only come from him, as he is cheerfully acknowledged by us who seek to serve him, who is the head over all things to the church. But then in Colossians 2:10 I read that he is the head of all principality and power. Now I know what Peter says in his epistle, in 1 Peter chapter 3, and the thought of union is not the idea here, but that angels and authorities and powers have been made subject to him. The whole idea is that the majesty of creation and the wonder of grace is this, that there is one solitary figure only in heaven and on earth, center of all, Lord of the universe. His name is high over all. It's the new name that's been given unto him who sits on the right hand of the majesty on high, the one of whose ecclesiastical glory we have been speaking. Verse 19, the verse about which we can't say very much, speaks of his essential and his eternal glory, for it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell. We must consider another verse in conjunction with this. It's verse 9 of chapter 2. For in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. These two verses describe his absolute deity. For all the attributes of deity, such as eternity of being, absolute sovereignty, and immutability, in all their totality are resident in him, thus saith the Scriptures. Two words are used for dwelling in the Scriptures. A temporary abode and a permanent dwelling. Now in Genesis 37 verse 1, both words are in view. That verse says, now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger. In other words, Jacob had his permanent abode in the land where his father Isaac had a temporary residence. Now I have said to you that here it denotes the permanent abode of all the attributes of deity in the person of Jesus Christ. Now let's take verse 19 first. For it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell. This is not referring to his incarnation, may I suggest to you, but refers to what John had in mind when he wrote about the eternal word, the Logos. Indeed, Colossians 1:19 corresponds to John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Whereas Colossians 2:9, which says, "For in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily," agrees with John 1:14, "and the Word was made flesh." For the interesting word in Colossians 2:9 is bodily or bodily wise, for in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily wise. He who was with God, in whom all fullness dwells, crowned his work by incarnation. That is the thought. He who was with God came to be with men. And John, as he wrote about him, thinking about him, and enabled to do by the Spirit of God, saw all the glory of the tabernacle, depicted in but superseded by the Christ, and so he said he tabernacled amongst us. That was the thought. For in humanity as in deity, all fullness is resident in him. So the hymn writer was quite correct when he said, "Of the full deity possessed, eternally divine." This is a fundamental truth of the Christian faith. And you will not have to repeat it very often in many places before you are challenged outright by all kinds of people whom you may have previously thought to be fine, upstanding, religious, perhaps even Christian brethren. I'm not talking about assembly brethren now. It is amazing how often you can talk about God in a mixed company and get away with it. Whenever you start to talk personally about Jesus Christ, his Son, then all manner of things happen. Eyebrows are raised, questions are asked, subject has changed, some people will rise and leave the room. Most people, you see, will come to compromise terms with you in speaking about God generally. But you bring into conversation the fact of a personal divine human relationship with Jesus Christ, and instantly there is opposition. What marks out the Christian faith as unique is that in which all naturalistic religions have made shipwreck. Jesus Christ is very God of very God, and very man of very man. And he has taken humanity to the very highest pinnacle of glory. Verse 20 says this, that he will reconcile all things unto himself, whether they be things in earth or things in heaven. I love all these verses, but I particularly like this one. For this one immediately projects one's mind to the Lord having come. Earlier I said I believed he was coming, and I do, and I repeat it. But this verse takes it a little bit beyond that. You see, the entrance of sin, as we very well know and so often speak about, brought discord and disharmony into the whole universe. Not only has man been alienated by wicked works from God, but the animal kingdom is in disorder. Earth itself groans and travails until now. Even the heavens are in disorder, and there are people with access there, or there are intelligences, shall I say, with access there, which makes the heavens not clean in his sight. But there is a time coming, for this verse envisages a millennial scene, when he will reconcile all things unto himself. in heaven and in earth. You know, at the rapture of the church, wonderful thought, blessed anticipation, there will not be a saved person left on earth. Now, I believe that. If I'm in dispute with you over it, please forgive me. But I believe that when the Lord comes and takes his church home, there will not be a saved person left on earth. I also believe that after the judgment of the living nations, there will not be an unsaved person left on earth. That all who are alive and remain after that great judgment scene will go justified into the millennial kingdom of Christ. And this is what we're looking at. You know, the other Sunday morning we were going to the worship meeting, my wife and my son and I, and we were following a very peculiar van. It was a Volkswagen, all glass at the back. And my son said, "Dad, that's too big for a dog. Get closer and let's see what it is." And disobeying the highway code, I got within feet of the back to see a big lioness in the back of this van, obviously on its way to the safari park at Blair Drummond. And it was beginning to shake itself as though from sedation and sit up and take notice. And we were passing a few fields where there were sheep and little lambs. And little Paul said to me, "I wonder what would happen, Dad, if something occurred to the van and the lioness got out. And see, there must be 80 or 100 lambs and sheep in that field." I said, "I'll tell you what's more wonderful than that, son. There's a day coming when the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the wolf shall lie down with the lamb, and the little child shall lead them. He will reconcile all things unto himself, things on earth and things in heaven. Blessed be his name." Can you imagine a day when there'll be no headlines in the newspapers, perhaps no newspapers, of dissension, of disharmony, of discord? It's almost impossible to take it in. We've become so acclimatized to living between crises, it's hard to imagine a time when every morning will only be a fresh revelation of his glory and of the wonderful reconciliation that will be effected when our adversary is bound and cast into the pit, and when the earth will yield as it never has done since the curse was placed upon it, and when the Lord himself will reign that wonderful millennial reign, albeit to end in disaster, yes, but he is going to reconcile all things unto himself. And let us not forget that he is master even of the disaster at the end, for that will come and will come to naught through his almighty power. And afterwards, there will be a new heaven and a new earth. The dispensation of the fullness of times, which will last for aeons of time. There is no terminal language used about it in the New Testament. And for millenniums upon millenniums, there will be revealed to all who dwell in the new heavens and the new earth that Jesus Christ is Lord. Not a dissenting voice, not a note of discord or disharmony. And when it's been clearly evidenced over that long period of time, however long it is, that he has subdued everything unto himself, and reconciliation to God the Father is utter and absolute and complete, then he shall deliver up the kingdom to him, and God shall be all in all. I think that's glorious. The prospect opening to the Christian's view is grander as the days go by. Verses 21 and 22 introduce us to his triumphal glory. This is wonderful. My brethren, read this with me. "He will present you holy, unblameable, unreprovable in his sight." He will present the church to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing. "We will be flawless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy," says Jude. "He and I in that bright glory one chief joy shall share, mine to be forever with him, his that I am there." Now, you know, he could have done this immediately after he saved us.
But from conversion until he comes and takes us, or until we go into his presence to be absent from the body, is a long or a short road, as the case may be. And the reason he hasn't taken us home immediately he saved us is for a specific purpose in his own divine wisdom. There is no doubt about his triumphal glory ultimately, as we have read. But he has a purpose for every one of us. Perhaps we'll see more about that in the second half of the conference. That would be the burden of my message today, to follow on like that. But you know, in the long road between, in the many vicissitudes, in all the ups and downs that represent the graph of our living from conversion until glory, there is a wonderful work being performed, a work of grace in your life and mine. And the outreaching effects of the impact of that work will not be known until that day, yet future. For he is purposing in himself through the church, through its corporate witness, through your individual witness, something that is precious to him, about which we know very little, although we are an integral part of it. There is no doubt about his triumphal glory. That word is settled forever in heaven. But between here and then, wonderful things are happening. Sometimes borrowed of deepest distress and tears and anxieties and disappointments. But he is over all. He is still on the throne. His word is right and true and accurate. He's accomplishing his will even in the most dire circumstances in which we may find ourselves. And one day he is going to translate all the ups and downs of that graph, the seemingly crooked things. He's going to make them plain. The story will be read. And out of circumstances in which you put your hand in his and clung desperately through simple faith, will perhaps be unfolded a glorious story, known presently to him. The threads of gold that form the relief pattern, the collars of eternal works known only to the Lord, and precious in his sight. The glories of Christ, may we learn to make them precious. May we learn to read them and to familiarize our hearts with them. May we let them grasp our affections constantly and turn our hearts and our minds and our thoughts worshipfully to him. For he is worth it.